good morning to you. You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we're going to revisit the topic of nanotechnology with a guest who I love talking to about this. His name is Pat Mooney. He is the executive director of the Etc. Group, and they are dedicated to the conservation and sustainable advancement of cultural and ecological diversity as well as human rights. Welcome back to our airwaves, Pat.
It's nice to be back.
Well, thank you for being available. Now, there's a whole lot of stuff that's happened in the field of nanotechnology since we last talked about it on this here program. For the listener, if you are feeling a little overwhelmed in the course of this program, it's just to sort of whet your appetite to go find out some more information. The Etc. Group has a couple of recent reports that we're going to be discussing, and you yourself can check them out following the conversation. So let's start out, Pat, by taking a look at kind of the broader political scene regarding nanotechnology. And this is not just a U.S. phenomena. This is a global phenomena. And some could argue that possibly the U.S. is not the world leader in nanotech, and some would say they are, but there's many countries kind of jockeying for position there. So just real briefly, to set some context, how would you assess the political situation regarding nanotechnology?
Well, to us, it seems pretty hot at the moment. It was a topic for the G8 when they met in Scotland a few weeks back. And there is work being done now by governments, including the U.S. government and Europeans and Japanese and Chinese and so on developing what might become a code of conduct, in fact, on how to handle nanotechnology. It's become that much of a concern in terms of its safety issues, especially in its economic implications by governments. I think everyone was a bit shocked when they did their calculations at the end of last year to realize that the total spending on basic research in nanotechnology is now around $10 billion. That was a lot higher than we'd expected, and it's really gone up very, very quickly. And I think perhaps even more shocking, particularly for the U.S. government, was that there are more scientists working on nanotechnology in the area around Beijing in China than there are in, for example, all of Western Europe. And they're, of course, working on it at 1/20th the cost of a European or an American scientist. So that's turned this into a kind of a geopolitical battle that governments are very concerned to be on top of the issue, to not lose ground to other parts of the world. And it's driven, again, the kind of discussions that are going on now with the G8.
I want to come back to the G8 conversations in a few minutes, but initially, I want to just go over real briefly the three sort of emerging approaches that you folks list in your July-August 2005 report, Nanogeopolitics. And those are, and I'll just run through these briefly and then get a little more detail from you. Those are the optimists who just say, technology is good and let's go full bore ahead, with, of course, responsible people in charge. Then there's the realists who are saying technology is neutral, let's incorporate some sort of public interest to help, possibly shape alternate routes, but we're still going forward with this. And then there's the skeptics, which you describe yourselves among in this report, where technology is political and maybe we shouldn't be going down this road, but we should be including everyone possible that's going to be impacted, which is all of us in this case, regarding this. Now, it seems like most of the governments and industry fall into the optimist camp, where this could only be a good thing, and any problems we'll figure out in the course of developing this, much in the same successful way we've done with all those other high-tech things like nuclear and biotechnology, et cetera, et cetera. So could you go into a little bit more detail about what the optimists are actually doing as opposed to what they're saying and how they're shaping and controlling the conversation?
These are their own descriptions, in a sense, of themselves. I would never have described that other category as being really realistic. I think they're unrealistic, but they like to see themselves that way. And the optimists, the same way, they like to describe themselves as being responsible, that they're taking a very careful, responsible approach to nanotechnology. They don't want to mess it all up with all kinds of government interventions and regulation. They simply want to go ahead, get the job done, being fully cognizant of the social concerns that were raised around biotechnology. They don't want to make those mistakes, they say. They're very aware of the social and societal implications of the technology, and with that in mind, they're going to proceed cautiously and carefully to make this the most wonderful thing since sliced bread. That is very much the view of industry, the view of most governments, in fact, as the G8 were discussing this and others. Again, they constantly use this phrase, responsible nanotechnology, and it really is there, I think, to persuade us in the public that don't worry, everything's being handled, and please don't ask us for regulations.
And it's the use of the word responsible that kind of sets your folks' alarm bells off, because of a industrial history of the use of the word responsible to sort of placate critics by saying, you know, we're being responsible about this. And you list examples in the chemical, food, and, I guess CFCs and pesticides fall under the chemical realm. But a lot of examples of people kind of heading off criticism by throwing the word responsible up on the title of a program or an outreach effort or something along those lines.
Yeah, and they tend to announce that they've established a trade association or a group of some kind that's going to make sure everybody's responsible, but that, again, will be based upon their own sort of informal and certainly not legal approach to sort of self-monitoring.
I'm sure that the maybe not the origin, but the consistent suggestion of using that term has its place deep within the public relations industry. As a way to get people to accept ideas.
Absolutely. I mean, the folks that have been making money in the last year in nanotechnology, more than the industry itself, have been the PR firms that are managing the public relations around this whole issue. I think in the last year and a half or 2 years, industry has recognized that it could have itself a public relations embarrassment, and so it's been very, very careful in how it describes nanotechnology and how they try to position themselves as they move ahead, trying not to over-exaggerate what might happen and trying not to get too much attention. In fact, we know a lot of the PR firms are even suggesting that they drop the term nanotechnology altogether and try to talk about, you know, use other language, whatever they can that will perhaps raise less attention.
Well, and I suppose that brings us straight into the, as mentioned in the report, techno-realists, or as you mentioned, the techno-unrealists, who are pretty much just saying, you know, technology is neutral, it can be good, it can be bad, and the way to get this through is to approach it as, being solely used as environmental or poverty alleviation applications, environmental cleanup, et cetera, and to really try and engage civil society, or at least handpicked parts of civil society, I suppose, to kind of further the debate and broaden the acceptance.
Yeah, I think even a better term for them might have been techno-fatalists. They really start off by assuming that the world is the way it is and it ain't going to change, and so the best that you can hope for is that some bitter piece of nanotechnology can be made to be more useful, and that perhaps by applying as much pressure as they know how, they'll persuade governments and industry to do better than otherwise. But it's a very fatalistic view of the whole situation. So they will often agree with us that there are many negatives out there related to the technology, lots to be concerned about in terms of health and the environment and human rights. But they say, well, let's just make the best of it, and we'll try to apply perhaps some of the work that's being done related to water purification or some of the work that's being done on alternative energy sources to nanotechnology, and maybe we'll get something good out of it, or we'll approach, again, nanotechnology as a pro-poor science that can be used somehow to help developing countries develop more rapidly than in the past.
And so that brings us lastly to the techno-skeptic, where, as I mentioned previously, Etc. Group considers itself in that camp. And this is primarily defined as looking at nanotechnology in the wider context of the history of high technology introduction and kind of just a general wariness of grand promises. It's going to solve everything. Everybody's going to be healthy. Everybody's going to be wealthy. And we're not going to have to work. Sounds like too cheap to meter nuclear electricity from 50 years ago.
It's exactly like that. It's I think, again, this drove us a bit crazy in the Glenn Eagles G8 meeting that we constantly were hearing in the build-up to it and then during it and in the follow-through afterwards that every problem that was raised had a technological solution, that poverty was a technical problem, climate change was a technical problem, that terrorism was a technical problem. Everything had a technical solution. There was a silver bullet to meet every agenda item that the G8 were considering. And that's just not the way the world is. To us, the issues are social issues, first and foremost, and in some cases, in some conditions, it may well be that there's some technology that might be helpful along the way, but you don't start off by assuming that, you know, you've got technology just to go out there and find a problem. That just isn't the way that the world should work, and I know that there was a lot of harmony in the G8 around making poverty history, the big phrase that was used and by the rock stars and the film stars that all showed up for the summit. But it seemed like the conclusion was really more make poverty chemistry. You know, rather than trying to do the hard, heavy lifting work of solving social problems, we'll just throw silver bullets at it.
And it's also the skeptics that continually assert the unfortunately sort of out of fashion concept, long established concept of the precautionary principle. Can you remind listeners what the precautionary principle is for folks who've never heard of it?
Well, in the United Nations, the precautionary principle says that you do no harm, that you, the first most important thing, it's like the Hippocratic Oath, you make sure that what you're introducing is going to be safe. And if you don't think it's going to be safe, if you have any reason to doubt that it's safe, then you don't introduce it. So this applies to biotechnology and GM crops, and applies to nanotechnology even more so. And it's established in the United Nations treaties that the precautionary principle exists. It's important, and governments have to abide by it. Of course, governments don't, and governments often, again, apply their own interpretation to it, which seems to be that you protect your not your environment or your people, but you protect your corporations and their profits first and foremost.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. We're talking about nanotechnology and political developments, and we're going to be talking about intellectual property developments and patenting. Pat Mooney, the executive director of the Etc. Group, is my guest this morning, and you can find out more about them online at www.etcgroup.org. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has links to them and some other information related to the program today. So let's get back to the G8 meeting in Glen Eagles Resort in Scotland that just happened about a month or so back. We're, as often, running a little short on time. So give us a snapshot of how they were discussing the future of nanotechnology and how much were they looking at issues related to things of precautionary principle nature, safety, environmental hazard, human toxicity, etc.
Well, they weren't discussing that latter part at all. They were really just looking at the opportunities in nanotechnology. In the lead-up to the G8 meeting, there was a whole series of smaller discussions that took place. The last one prior to the G8 itself was a meeting of G8 science ministers that took place in Vancouver in Canada just a few weeks before. And again, in all of these discussions that were leading up to it, both Tony Blair and our Prime Minister in Canada, Paul Martin, were especially pushing the idea that a major solution for poverty, a major solution for environmental issues, was nanotechnology. We also believe that one of the reasons why your president supported the idea of climate change, finally, in the lead up to Glenn Eagles, was because, again, he was seeing it and it was being presented to him by Blair as a problem that could be solved by technology, that in fact there'd be ways to support the nanotech industry in the industrialized countries so that they would take on the climate change issue and Kyoto could be ignored. Science was sort of seen as again the political solution for most of these issues.
Now, at this point, I'm going to use that to segue to the second report I wanted to get to. There's a whole ton more information regarding seven emerging initiatives that could impact nanotechnology policy that I'm just going to let people pursue on their own. It has to do with some of what we've talked about a little bit. But to get to the issue of intellectual property and patenting, I'm going to have to forego the other part of that July-August 2005 report, Nanogeopolitics. Now, the issue of intellectual property and patenting is huge, and it seems to be at this point, and maybe I'm just reading this wrong as sort of an outsider on all this, but it seems to be the key goal right now of a lot of research institutions to establish patents on very foundation-level processes, applications, technologies, and even materials. And this relates to what's widely referred to as the Global South, and in specific, Africa and the G8 conversations. So could you set a little context regarding intellectual property, patents, nanotech, poverty, etc.?
Sure. Well, patents are the major tool used by industry to sort of declare turf, to say that this territory of technology belongs to us. They're really no longer a tool of innovation. They haven't been for many, many years. They're really a tool that big companies can use to threaten away little companies or to prevent other companies from moving into a certain field of research or business activity. The costs of patents are so high, not really the costs of obtaining a patent, though that's high enough, but really the cost of maintaining it, of being able to defend your patent in civil courts is so high that usually it just takes a big company sidling up beside a little company saying, gee, that patent of yours looks like it's a violation of our patent. Do you want to fight about it? The little company can't afford the fight, so ultimately they either surrender their patent or they get absorbed by the bigger company. That's the kind of a tool that the patent system has become. There isn't a global patent system. It's really a series of national laws around the world. But the U.S. model of patenting, which is the most extreme model in the world in terms of everything is patentable in the United States, is becoming the norm for the rest of the world. And the U.S. is often able to impose its patents on other countries, including in Africa, to say that you can't do that work, you can't have that product or process because that would be a violation of a patent that's been taken out in Washington. And other, because the U.S. is such a powerful force in the world, other governments give up and surrender to the U.S. patent system and allow U.S. law to pertain around the world. So that's the kind of concern that we have about the patent system. When it comes to a new area of technology like nanotech, the shock for us is that the patent examiners don't know how to handle it. They're not familiar with the new technology. They're given an application, they don't understand what they're reading, and they accept, often in the early stages of a technology, they accept incredibly broad, sweeping patents that they would never have accepted in a more sophisticated or more mature industry. And those first patents can just be overwhelming. They can just settle the turf for the rest of the history of the technology. And that's happening with nanotech. We're seeing patents being granted, which, in fact, two patents have been granted already some time ago, in fact, on two elements of the periodic table. It's absolutely illegal to patent elements in the periodic table in any country.
Yeah, that was fascinating to read.
Sorry?
That was fascinating to read in this report, Nanotech's Second Nature Patents, that you can actually patent an element.
Well, again, you can, but the whole thing about the patent system is that every law, every aspect of the patent system has been broken many, many times. And unless someone in the civil courts wants to go after the company that broke that rule, you can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And the precedent gets established, and then they carry on from there. But patents have also been granted that are actually more alarming than that. The patents that say that the uses of certain elements in the periodic table in certain ways would be a violation of a patent. And patents have been granted in the last few months even, that claim the use of even up to, in one case, 33 different elements in the periodic table. However they're used in this sort of at the nanoscale, that would amount to a violation of the company's patent. So you get just shockingly broad patents that really are laying claim to chunks of the periodic table in one way or another, directly or indirectly, and will be with us to haunt us for decades to come. So we just find that activity quite alarming. Especially it's alarming because, you know, the periodic table, the elements, are the building blocks of not just telephones and radios. They're the building blocks of life. DNA is really made up of hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, and oxygen. And if you can start to patent various kinds of carbon, you're on your way to owning the building blocks of life.
Who has a lot of these patents? I'm assuming that, you know, large entities, government, research facilities, industry, you know, are pursuing these with a vigor sort of unknown in recent history. As you folks quote in this report, Mark Lemley from the Stanford Law School says, quote, patents will cast a larger shadow over nanotech than they have over any other modern science at a comparable stage of development. Yep. So who's pursuing these patents?
Well, again, virtually everybody, the biggest corporations in the world, the IBMs and the Hewlett-Packards and the Boeings and the Toshibas and the, you name it, they're all involved in it. The food companies and the pharmaceutical companies as well, but also very small companies sometimes, very small startup companies are with venture capital funds, are very quick off the mark and have often got more lawyers on their staff now, patent lawyers on their staff, than they actually have scientists, and they're really just scrounging through patent files and trying to develop new patents that they can claim. And so that's all underway, and again, it's a wild west out there that everyone is out gunning for the broadest patent they can possibly get and trying to make something out of it. The part that scares us as well here is that, and it kind of belies the question of who has got these patents, because you can get a patent granted to a company, to a telecommunications company or a computer company, and that patent description will be such that the technology they're patenting will apply as much to computers as it does to food, mm-hmm. as it does to drugs, as it does to automobile manufacturing. Yeah, so for the first time ever in history, we're seeing patents granted that actually can cut across all of the sectors of the economy.
Right, because nanotechnology is more a process that can be applied across many different sectors, as opposed to a specific thing in itself.
And exactly. So you get a patent examiner who deals with electronics normally, and suddenly he's granting a patent that has profound implications for food and drugs. And has no idea that's what he's done.
And what you're referring to here is the idea of a cross-industry patent, where, you know, you intend it for one thing, but in fact it addresses five different sectors, and now your patent applies to them as well. Even though we're running a little short on time here, I want to address just briefly what you reference in the title of this report, Second Nature Patents. The technology exists to now combine living tissue and mechanical and electronics. And this field is referred to as nanobiotechnology. Can you explain a little bit about what's happening with nanobiotechnology and kind of what's the cutting edge in terms of ability in the field?
Well, you know, a few years ago, Michael Crichton wrote a book called Prey, which looked at nanotechnology, and he got everybody sort of panicked that we were going to see tiny little tin soldiers, invisible in size, that we're going to sort of build machines. They would be little machines that would act like living materials. In fact, it's really the other way around. What we're seeing with nanobiotechnology, and this is the biggest area of investment by the venture capitalists in nanotech, is work that's actually taking life and adapting life to perform machine functions. With nanotechnology, it's critical to have a capacity for self-replication. And DNA, of course, replicates beautifully, has been doing it for billions of years. And the attraction for the industry is that then they can simply tweak the DNA of living materials, whether it's a bacterium or a person, or anything in between, and to make it function in different ways, to make it actually be the construction agent or the robotic agent for the building of almost anything else that we'd ever care to build, from a hamburger to a table. And that really is the intriguing work that's going on. And again, it's a huge area of research. We're estimating that about 61% of all of the investment, in fact, in research in the private sector side of nanotechnology is in this nano-bio interface.
I just want to kind of close out the conversation here with another quote referenced in the report. This is from Rodney Brooks. He's the director of Artificial Intelligence Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. This is a quote from a book put out in 2002. Quote, "Much of what we manufacture now will be grown in the future through the use of genetically engineered organisms that carry out molecular manipulation under our digital control." And here's the clincher. "Our bodies and the material in our factories will be the same. We will begin to see ourselves as simply a part of the infrastructure of industry." That's scary, that idea.
It absolutely is, and it is how they're thinking. That we've been reduced to the level of, again, the elements in the periodic table, and those elements can be owned and controlled. And that's what's fascinating, of course, for the largest corporations, that they can actually get to the fundamentals of life and of nature and control them.
Pat Mooney has been my guest this morning. He's the executive director of the Etc. Group, and we've been discussing nanotechnology, some of the political, geopolitical implications of recent conversations, as well as some of the intellectual property and patenting developments. Thank you very much for returning to the program to talk about this, Pat.
Thanks for having me on again.
And we'll definitely have you back, because you got this stuff down. You can find out more about the Etc. Group online at www.etcgroup.org, and the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has links to them, as well as some additional information. Thanks once again, Pat.
Thank you.
If you'd like to contact me about anything you heard today or any other day here on the program, you can do so via email at kboo@riseup.net. You can also send me regular mail down here, KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I thank you very much for listening to the program.